The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances, and we are in our final day. During the noon hour starting Tuesday, the show will move to 4 p.m. weekdays and run up until 5 when we move to All Things Considered, as we do now from NPR. So it's our last noon show, and it should be a nice one. On our show today, we will be previewing a tribute show that will be happening at the Allerton Music Barn Festival at Allerton Park in Monticello by the University of Illinois jazz faculty. They're paying tribute to Oliver Nelson's album from 1961 called The Blues and the Abstract Truth. We have trombonist Jim Pugh and bassist Larry Gray with us, and also Oliver Nelson Jr., who will be performing on that program and also moderating. He is Oliver Nelson's son, as you would expect from that name. We'll be talking about the album, about the musician, and more on the show today. It's live and local. Stay tuned. That was a tune called Blues and the Abstract Truth from an album by Oliver Nelson that's actually called More Blues and the Abstract Truth. And the sort of the irony is, the reason it's called More is that the definitely his most famous album has that same name, The Blues and the Abstract Truth, although there's no tunes of that name on that CD. And there it goes from there. But on that recording, Thad Jones, Daniel Moore, Phil Woods, Phil Bodner, Ben Webster, Pepper Adams, Roger Kellaway, Richard Davis, and Grady Tate all performing on that one. Oliver Nelson himself not performing on that particular CD, but he's certainly on the original Blues and the Abstract Truth. The reason we're talking about this is that on Saturday night, tomorrow night at the Allerton Music Barn Festival, the University of Illinois jazz faculty, nearly all of them, are converging on the stage in the barn during this sixth annual festival to pay tribute to Oliver Nelson's The Blues and the Abstract Truth, the album, not the tune necessarily, although, as it turns out, they'll be playing their rendition of the tune you just heard. We're pleased to have two of the faculty members who will be on that concert with us on the show. Jim Pugh's been on quite a number of times, a trombonist on faculty. First time on the show is bassist Larry Gray, and very pleased to have him on. And our special guest is Oliver Nelson Jr., who, as you would expect from the name, is the son of the original Oliver Nelson. And very pleased to have you here, Oliver, as well. And I understand that you're a student as of what, this fall?
As of last fall.
So you've been here for a year.
This is my second year.
Oh, in the jazz program.
And really enjoyed. I just consider it a privilege to be here to study with these guys. They've been very, very cordial to me. They're very knowledgeable and great players, but they're great human beings, and that's the thing that really makes me feel good about being at the school. I'm learning a lot, but they are really helping me too, and that's a wonderful thing.
Well, and I can imagine that you're bringing some things to them as well. I mean, I don't know what your experience is in the past. You can certainly tell us, but you have the pedigree, so to speak.
That I do, and I hope I'm bringing some things here too. It's interesting, the concert that we're going to play tomorrow night, Blues and the Abstract Truth, of course, was not on the original album, as you said, but I was looking through some pictures the other day, and there's always been a version of the big band Blues and the Abstract Truth, but I found the one that Pepper Adams and those guys actually played on the small group stuff, which is the one you guys have, and nobody has seen that music for 50 years or 40 years. So I had it, and it was with some pictures. I said, oh, this is good, and we can play this. So I've got three of the original tunes that was written for small group for that album.
Wow.
So it's going to be interesting. We're going to do Blues and the Abstract Truth album, but we're going to actually do the tune Blues and the Abstract Truth, which wasn't on the original album in the first place.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask, before I ask what I was going to ask, and hopefully I'll remember, why a tribute to this album? I mean, I printed out somebody's list of the top 25 jazz albums of all time, And of course, that's highly subjective. This one's on that particular person's list. I printed out the somebody's list of the top 100. This one is on that particular list. Why this particular album? What made you all decide that you wanted to put this one up? Is it because Oliver Jr. is here?
No. I can let me talk a little bit about Jim, and I'll let you. I'm sorry to jump in. But what happened was 2011 was the 50th anniversary of the recording of that. And that's the reason that we're doing it. We actually performed it at the Jazz Education Network back in January of this last year. And so I thought it would be kind of cool, and I talked to Chip McNeil about this, to kind of duplicate that because it's the 50th anniversary. And actually, Impulse put out a series of the first like 9 or 10 albums that were done on Impulse. And this album was one of the first 10, along with John Coltrane and J.J. Johnson. So that's kind of the way that we thought about this. Is the 50th anniversary was here. It'd be cool to do it. You got great musicians here that could play it. And that was how it kind of came about.
And obviously, Oliver, you knew your dad, although not for as long as you would have liked.
Right.
And Jim, I understand you knew Oliver Sr. and Larry also?
No.
And you never encountered him?
Yeah, not technically worked with him, but I was a student at the Eastman School of Music in its fledgling years of having a jazz program. And I guess my third year there, they brought in this incredible teacher, writer who had been in New York City by the name of Ray Wright. And he had worked in New York for so long, was very good friends with Oliver, actually was very good friends with a lot of the jazz community. He was buddies with Clark Terry and Phil Woods, all these people. But one of the first things he did to help put that program on the map, since they also graciously funded him very well when, you know, he was building the program up there, but one of the first things he did with the studio orchestra that he had there was organize a commission and a tour of performances with the Eastman Studio Orchestra with Oliver. And Oliver was commissioned to write himself basically a jazz concerto, saxophone concerto. And he came and obviously played it and toured with us. So we were out, you know, hanging out with him on the road and stuff. It was quite an experience for all of us youngsters at that point to have this, because he was an icon certainly to us at that point too, and all of a sudden have this star, and finally he's just hanging out late night, and was so gracious and so energetic and so giving and sharing of his, you know, of his knowledge to all us neophytes. That it was quite an experience.
Did he, I know Larry, you said you hadn't met him on any occasion, but did his work and his and this album in particular figure in your education in some way, in your own early experience?
Well, there's probably several ways that he figured in my, and that I remember him. And one is a very famous book that he wrote called Patterns for Jazz, or it's also called Patterns for Saxophone. Sometimes it had different names, but it was a great book to play out of. So that's the first time I remember seeing his name. And then, of course, I was acquainted with the record, you know, Blues and the Abstract Truth, which is a really interesting record, and from many standpoints, particularly its eclecticism. You know, to hear Eric Dolphy playing a solo followed by Oliver, it's like two different world views right there in and of itself. The way the rhythm section that was assembled for that date with Bill Evans, Paul Chambers, and Roy Haynes was three people that you wouldn't normally see together. So that was cool. I was enamored with a record of Oliver's called Live in Los Angeles, I think. Or no, what was it called?
Yeah, Live in Los Angeles.
Yeah, the one with Tom Scott and Frank Strozier, and great big band. A lot of great people on that. But what's that guy's? Oh, I'm losing track of somebody's. Yeah. Oh no, Bobby. Somebody on Trump. Bobby Bryant.
Bobby Bryant.
Yeah, Bobby Bryant.
Good family friend.
Yeah. So that was a really cool record. A young Tom Scott, who was about 17, playing, sounding great on saxophone.
Yeah. So
and of course we knew Oliver from all of his. I didn't know it, but I was hearing his music when I was watching such TV programs as Night Gallery.
Yeah, I just read that. I hadn't realized that. Yeah. I mean, you never do know who writes this music. Ironside was one of them.
Oh, yeah, he did that. Interestingly, to dovetail off of what Larry just said, probably people will know him more that come to the concert by stuff that he had done for television. And one of the big things was, I don't know if you ever saw Shrek the Third, Well, I'm sitting in a movie studio with my grandkids, and I watched a 4-minute segment. All of a sudden, I said, "That's your grandfather's music." They said, "Oh, you got to be kidding!" I said, "No, that's your grandfather's music." So we had to wait till the end of the movie, and of course, they gave him credit for that. But his biggest hit as far as the popular scene is the theme song from the Six Million Dollar Man.
I saw that on the list too.
and actually, this last year, and it was a cha-ching moment for my family. Mazda used that music in their television commercial about their little CX-5 or whatever, and it was shown on the NCAA finals and all over. I think they're still showing it now. So we've had a couple of times where there was GM used it a long time ago when they rebuilt the Chevy Trailblazer. AOL has used it before. Scrubs, I mean, there's tons of commercials and kind of stuff that have used that. And so that probably is the one that people will recognize even more. If you're a child of the 70s, everybody watched that show. And that was, he wrote for that show up until he died. So he did a lot there. But that was one of the big things about him. He was never really locked into a particular genre of anything. They told him when he was in school that he would never be able to be a film composer. He went to California and he proved him wrong with that. So he could do pretty much anything. And that's the thing that I really, and Jim is just a great composer. And I can just see how he looked and was really interested in Dad because of the compositional skills. And he's just if you've never heard his works out there, folks, he's a great composer and a great trombonist and just a pretty nice guy.
He's a pretty nice guy. Pretty nice guy.
Aw, shucks.
You can go now, Jim. You got your you got your kudos.
My work is done here.
Well, you know, when I saw the name, the album name, you know, I'm one of these people who is, I imagine like many of our listeners, I'm a fan of jazz. I'm not overly knowledgeable about jazz. I know a lot of names. I actually knew the names of all the performers, and I even knew what instruments they played, except, ironically, Oliver Nelson. And so when I saw Oliver Nelson's Blues in the Abstract Truth, I don't think I know that, until I actually went and listened to it. And then I heard what I gather is the biggest hit from this album, which is the opening tune on the track. And as soon as it started to play, I thought, oh, I know at least this song. And it's called Stolen Moments. And maybe you'll have the same recognition moment that I just did. So here we go. This is Stolen Moments from Oliver Nelson's A Blues from the Abstract Truth. Larry mentioned some of the other musicians. Oliver Nelson on the alto and tenor sax, not sure which one he's playing on this tune. Eric Dolphy, alto sax and flute. Freddie Hubbard is trumpeter. George Barrow on barry sax. Bill Evans, the pianist. Paul Chambers, bass. And Roy Haynes, the drums on Live and Local. Well, we're coming down in the middle of the solo of trumpeter Freddie Hubbard from Stolen Moments by Oliver Nelson from the CD called Blues in the Abstract Truth. And the University of Illinois Jazz faculty, along with Oliver Nelson Jr., will be performing music from that album at the Allerton Music Barn Festival Saturday night at 7:30. And we were just sort of speculating, well, what if all the rain that is supposed to happen happens and it gets really loud, what's going to happen? And I gather that if that happens, the thing will move to Craner Center. Is that definitely true?
I don't know if that's 100% at this point. That's what we did last year when we had the heat.
Well, we'll try to find out, and at least announcements will be made. But the question I wanted to ask you earlier, which is, are you guys going to be recreating the album? Are you going to be doing things inspired by the album, some of the tunes from the album, all the above, or what's going to be happening?
Kind of all the above, because I know, Jim, you've got an arrangement of Teeny's Blues. On the original album, Teeny's Blues is only done by two alto saxophone players and rhythm section. Mm-hmm. But I think that Chip told me that you had something.
Well, we had done, it was really interesting, two tours ago, the 2009 tour with Steely Dan that I've been playing with them for a number of years now. But we did... We always have a band opening number, you know, for we are our own opening act.
Sure.
And Donald Fagen finds, he's such a jazz aficionado, and he'll find something really unique or off the wall or something in his collection that he found. And one year he wanted to do Teeny's Blues. He heard it. So Michael Lenhardt, who's the trumpet player, did a really interesting chart on it. I mean, the presentation of the tunes pretty much exactly was what, except expanded for four horns. But then in the middle of it, he actually orchestrated bits and chunks of Eric Dolphy's solo, which is really...
Wow.
And considering it's Eric Dolphy, it's a pretty wacky little little chorus, but it's a lot of fun. And I talked to Chip and said, I have this chart, and it was okay with Michael for us to use it. He said, well, yeah, because it's already for the four horns that we have, you know, so... But that's the only thing that's going to actually depart from...
Except the fact, too, Jim, that we're actually going to do Blues in the Abstract Truth, which was not on the original album either. Yeah. But I think that's kind of cool that I have the original music. It's 40 years old, and nobody's done this like this but us. So I think that kind of makes us... Sure. This is kind of unique. Also, another thing I wanted to point out is there are only two people that are still alive on that original album. And that's the 81-year-old Roy Haynes, who's still playing today and playing his buns off. And George Barrows, who plays baritone saxophone, and that was as of last year, he's still alive, but everybody else has passed away. So it's an interesting thing.
Well, when I saw the date of the album, I thought, hey, this album was born the year I was. So
right.
I feel like I guess I need to know this one a lot better than I do. There was used to be a feature, maybe they still run it every once in a while on a program we used to air on this station called Performance Today. And this guy used to do a thing called What Makes It So Great, about classical tunes of various kinds. And I guess that's my question about this one. You know, so many people consider it to be one of the great jazz albums. And why is that? You started to get on it a little bit, Larry, earlier.
Yeah, sure enough. I guess everyone has their own feelings about it. I mean, it's sort of it seems like it's just an occurrence that happened. It wasn't reflective of a working group like many jazz records are, like Miles recordings. And I think it's a unique mix of things, of styles and influences. Even Oliver himself, you know, I really don't know that much about his work, like as a horn player. And I read a little bit about his background. On one tune, you could hear that sort of like that territory band influence and that early style. And then oftentimes he presents this sort of austere, sort of classical, almost style, like the way he comes in on Stolen Moments after Eric Dolphy's flute solo, which is very Eric Dolphy, you know, and yet maybe a little more conservative than some of his other stuff. But it's a real stark contrast. So there are a lot of these kind of stark contrasts, and it's interesting to compare it to Kind of Blue, which I think has
Miles Davis.
Has some similarities. Does have the same piano player and bass player. And yet it's very, very different. And part of its difference is the difference in the compositional voices. Oliver's style was a little different than what was going on with Miles. And yet there are similarities. I think, I don't know, it just seemed wide ranging would be the words that I would use. Wide ranging and maybe eclectic.
One of the commentaries that I read about this album said that, you know, often when somebody writes a jazz tune or creates an album, that it seems that the music is a vehicle for the soloists. And using this album as a contrast to that, where the composition somehow, I'm not sure what was implied, is more seamless, and the melodic content itself more important maybe than sometimes happens?
Well, I think so, but...
And the harmonic content, of course.
The harmonic content, if you listen to the voicings, they're very close. A lot of minor seconds and that kind of stuff throughout. But Dad was because of his writing, he was a big proponent, like Duke Ellington, of trying to write stuff that fit the musicians that he was playing with. And his history was, he and Eric Dolphy had recorded a bunch of tunes on Prestige all the time. So they played, and there was always a lot of contrast. Dad would write the tunes, but he always tried to make these vehicles, because Eric used minor seconds. He played that way. He used a lot of that dissonance that was then in effect. And so he kind of wrote for the guys that he had available. He talks about George Barrows on the album, the big, fat, you know, baritone saxophone sound. So, and to dovetail on Larry, I think, first of all, you had the cast of characters, which was kind of unique. Dad had never worked with Paul Chambers and Bill Evans. And actually, I talked to Roger Calloway, who was on the More Blues in the Abstract Truth album about a year ago. And he said one of the things that Dad mentioned to him, he said, you know, he was new. He was 1959, he did his first recording on Prestige. So this is 61, this is 2 years later.
Your dad was new.
Yeah, my dad was new. But to be in the presence of Paul Chambers and Bill Evans and those guys was a big deal for him. Mm-hmm. You know, just to be around those kind of guys was huge. And, you know, Freddie was young then, but he was playing his buns off at the time. So it was a unique mix. It was a certain particular time in history that this happened. It's kind of like Kind of Blue. You never duplicate it twice. And I think that's what really makes the album unique. Dad played a lot on there, but the writing was the thing. That's the thing that kind of catapulted him more than anything else. He was a great saxophone player, but he was a great writer. And then the writing skills took him to Hollywood. So, I mean.
Yeah.
Any further take on that, Jim?
No, I think this is along the lines with a few of those other albums that, like Larry had mentioned. This is, I mean, in Oliver, since we're talking about the composition part of it, he was someone who came along and had a very, very organized approach to his composition. He, you know, had studied the masters of classical composition, was applying a lot of those tenets to jazz music, which there were a number of people that were doing that at the same time. Oliver's ability to bring a clarity to his writing was sort of unique. Even in like in that tune that we playing at the beginning, Blues in the Abstract Truth, there's all these what boiled down to 12 tone because he's stacking all these fourth motions, but he's having like counterpoint again, so it's getting very, very thick, but you still can ascertain what each line is doing. You know, it's very, very dense, and yet it's very clear at the same time. It was very unique. Part of it's the compositional skill, part of it's his orchestration skill, in that to keep these two very disparate elements of the music still very obvious, the complexity plus the clarity. So I think that the other part of it we were talking about earlier is Creed Taylor was the producer on this. And I actually got to know him pretty well. I worked for him for about 5 years, right, writing for him. And his unique thing was that he would put together these assemblages of musicians that you would never think were going to work. Right. Not only about finding, he was always looking for a jazz hit for one thing, but so he's also looking for compositional things, but he also would throw together these piles of musicians that you just wouldn't think, and it would come out with these amazing collaborations that all of a sudden stuff like this would happen, like throwing these people against each other, throwing Eric Dolphy in with Bill Evans.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's, you know, that's harmonically and melodically two approaches that are so diametrically opposed.
So with this particular album, we're talking about at least three layers. One is the wonder of the composition, one is the wonder of the performances, and one is the behind-the-scenes genius of the producer to put these guys together in the first place.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of stuff comes together to create this, you know, this iconic recording.
And the U of I Jazz faculty will be recreating it on Saturday night, tomorrow night, at the Allerton Music Barn Festival. It's a tribute to Oliver Nelson's The Blues and the Abstract Truth. And I know Jim Pugh and Larry Gray, you got to go actually play for the students in about half an hour.
That's right.
So we need to let you take off. Oliver, can you stick around for a little bit?
I can stick around as long as they let me sign my sheet when I come over when they play. So I'll be
there. I'm sorry you're absent.
Thanks, Jim.
We'll send you down with an absence pass.
Can I say one thing, though, before we go? I just want to really take my hat off to Larry. Larry's a great musician, a great human being. And if my dad were alive, he would definitely use him. When I first heard Larry, I mean, I put him in the Ron Carter, Rufus Reed category. He's a great player. Just lays it down. He can do the ones and fives like Ray Brown. And then he can just do all kinds of great solos. So just being around these guys, I'm just telling you, is a very, very inspirational thing for me, man. I couldn't ask for better. I'm kind of like, I pinch myself sometimes. You mean it's 2:30 in the afternoon, I'm listening to these guys play music? It's just a great thing. So I just wanted
to say
that.
Let's get a gig.
Okay.
Yeah. Give me a gig.
Okay.
Well, everybody gets a chance to hear all these guys on Saturday night. I'll be there. I'll be introducing the concert, and I'm really looking forward to it. Larry and Jim, thanks very much, and have a good day, and hope the weather holds.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you for doing this, Kevin.
Sure. Here's a little bit from the second tune that is on The Blues and the Abstract Truth. This is called Hoedown by Oliver Nelson.
Hoedown. We'll be right back.
It's called Hoedown by Oliver Nelson, featuring Oliver Nelson and Eric Dolphy on saxes, Freddie Hubbard trumpet, George Barrow barry sax, Bill Evans piano, Paul Chambers bass, Roy Haynes drums. The album's called The Blues and the Abstract Truth, and the jazz faculty at the University of Illinois will be doing kind of a recreation of that album, a tribute to that album, Saturday night at the Allerton Music Barn Festival at Allerton Park in Monticello. That festival, by the way, continues tonight with a performance of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance. In case you wanted to show up and get tickets, don't count on it. Apparently that's quite sold out, and we'll just hope that that the weather holds well enough for them to put that on without any trouble. My special guest for the rest of this hour is Oliver Nelson Jr., who is a student, which seems funny to say, at the University of Illinois. I mean, you must be about my age, I assume.
I think I'm older than you.
Are you
I think I'm
older?
The oldest person in the music school, including teachers, because I'm 57, so I've been around. I was born in 1955, so I've been around a long time, but interestingly enough, in 1969 or 70, my dad played at Smith Hall.
Really?
And I came up to visit with him, and we stayed in the Illini building in the rooms there.
The Union?
Yeah, the Union. So I'm going to give my recital there on October 21st. So I'm going to end up playing in the same building that my dad played in 40 some years later. So it's really interesting just to come to the building. I kind of remembered some of the stuff. School has changed, but it was very interesting, and he would be very proud to see me in school.
Well, I know you play flute and piccolo because you're going to be doing that on this concert.
Right.
Are you a saxophonist?
I'm the only jazz DMA student that plays the flute. And Chip
as
McNeil,
a first instrument.
As a first instrument. So I play with the Latin Jazz Ensemble with Tito, and I have to transpose a lot of parts for me for that, which is fine. And then I play in normal jazz ensembles, so it works real well. But I'm the only flute player. And actually, I'm doing a minor in classical flute, so I studied with Jonathan Keeble. Mm-hmm. And I was in a lesson today, and Jonathan said, "Oliver," he said, "don't play those jazz notes so much when you warm up." I said, "Okay, Jonathan."
Did he have a good reason for that?
I don't know. I don't know why. He said, "Just do more long tones." So, because I always play diminished scales and stuff, he said, "Do more long tones when you come out." I said, "That's fine, Jonathan."
He wants you to develop a beautiful tone.
That's right, and he's a great teacher for that. Just a great. He's another one, just a great human being and a great player and a great teacher. And I feel real privileged to be here.
Well, I have to ask a question since about the sax and flute thing. I know if you're a jazz saxophonist, it is generally strongly encouraged that you become a doubler at some of the other saxes,
right,
but also frequently the flute and the clarinet.
Right.
Does it not go the other way around that if you're a jazz flutist, you pick up the sax and maybe the clarinet as well?
Well,
or at least not in your case.
And you can pick them up, and a lot of people do just because they get more gigs that way. But what I found out in my experience, because I played saxophone for many, many years, and I stopped playing it probably about 20, 25 years ago. If you really want to play the flute well, you need to really stick with the flute. And saxophone is the same way. I mean, you can double. There's some guys that really sound well on the flute that double. But if you want to play that instrument, it just demands so much to play it well. One of my big influences was Hubert Laws. And Hubert went to Juilliard, studied with Julius Baker up there. And he just was a flute player's flute player. Mm. Well, he knew the technique. He had the great sound. A lot of the flute players you hear that double are sharp. And then they have some chops, but they just don't sound good. So I said, I'm just going to kind of dedicate myself to that instrument. And that's why I decided to do that. But there's a few guys that have gone back the other way as flute players, but you don't see it very often.
Yeah, usually a jazz flutist is okay. You know,
right.
You can really tell they're doubling. Well, what made you decide to give up the sax?
I just got hooked one day on Hubert. Actually, Hubert did a couple of albums with my dad. He did one with the Count Basie Orchestra. And then my dad did an album and wrote music for Langston Hughes' poems. And so Hubert was on that album. And then I heard his Afro Classics album. This is like 1970. And my dad gave me a flute, and I went into a closet about 2 days trying to get a flute sound out of that thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't come out too much. And I was just hooked on what he could do with the instrument, how well the instrument sounded. And I guess I was thinking about marketing, but from a marketing standpoint, it kind of put you in a niche market. because there's a ton of saxophone players out there all the time. But if you can play great bebop and that kind of stuff on the flute, you just don't hear it very much.
No, you don't.
No, so I just kind of figured that would be a great way to kind of differentiate myself from the rest. I did a improvisation workshop for Jonathan Keeble last year for the flute students, and you know, a lot of them are not don't know anything about that jazz world at all. But for me to be able to, if I can play Mozart concerto and I can play the blues too, it kind of gives you an edge on work. you can do more stuff. So that's why I kind of looked at it.
Does that make you the Wynton Marsalis of the flute?
I wish. Wynton is an amazing human being and an amazing player. But my goal is to be able to play both genres and function in both genres, and that's why I'm doing what I do.
Tell me what you have been doing that brought you, and then what brought you to the University of Illinois?
Interesting story. I have a bachelor's of music ed. I got a master's in classical flute, and I studied with Cameron Ratz, who's the principal of the Indianapolis Symphony. Mm-hmm. Worked a regular sales job. I was working for a company that is owned by a gas utility in Indiana, and did performance contracting for schools. So we'd come in like a school, like, and actually the company I used to work for did a project at the veterinarian school. They put new heating system, cooling system, lights, and they have a savings guarantee yearly. And if you don't meet that guarantee, the company has to pay them back money. So I did that a long time. The main reason I did it was to get my kids through college and to do that kind of thing. But the gas company in Indianapolis paid for me to get my master's degree in flute performance, which is kind of a unique thing. So my last son, 24 years old, graduated 2 years ago. I said, you know what? If I'm ever going to try to be a full-time musician, try to learn this stuff, this is the time to do it. So I left my job, auditioned. Chip McNeil was so gracious and allowed me to be in the school. And so the rest is kind of history. So I'm struggling with all the other students over there.
And talk a little bit about your memories of your dad.
Real great memories. Spent a lot of time. The interesting things for me would be I'd sit next to Phil Woods and Pepper Adams, and these guys are scuffling to play parts. And you're talking about the best jazz musicians in the world. And Dad would write music that was just difficult to play. He did an album called Sound Piece, and actually he sent the guys home because they couldn't play the music the first day. So they stopped the recording session. They went home and practiced and came back the next day to record it. So just being around those people, you know, meeting Lena Horne and just numerous other musicians that I've seen. Duke Ellington came to the house, and I have a picture of Ron Carter and Thad Jones at my grandmother's house in St. Louis, and staying up with my dad at night when he would write for television. He'd write all night. We'd drive the music out to the studio. They would copy it, and at 8 o'clock he'd get up and we'd have to have a sound session. So being through all those kinds of things was a very unique experience.
Did you ever get to play with him?
Got a chance to play with him at his old school, Washington University. He studied composition there, and he called me up on stage. I didn't know he was going to call me. He gave me a saxophone. I got a chance to play a solo with some really great musicians. Joe Sample was playing on the gig, and I can't remember some of the other guys, so I got a chance to play with him. Just being around him, hanging around him and learning stuff and trying different things out, and he would test me to see what I knew. He said, oh, you'll do all right. So it was kind of a real unique. Went to Africa with him. He took a State Department tour at a septet, and this was before the Fender Rhodes was popular, so he had to write the horn parts and make it sound like chords so that they could play over them. Frank Stroger was on the gig. John Clemmer, I don't know if you remember John. He was a Chicago saxophone player that kind of did the thing with echo plexus and stuff. This is a long, long time ago. So if you ever get a chance to kind of check something out. But he had a great group. People were losing passports, the whole deal, but it was fun.
Do you have any, let's go back to the record a little bit, The Blues and the Abstract Truth. What do you have a particular favorite off of here yourself?
Actually, I like all of them a lot, but there's one called Yearning, and it's a really great tune. It's been done by Big Band, and it's a blues with a twist, and Bill Evans just plays really well on there. The groove is set, and it just is really a great tune. So that's one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Freddie Hubbard's going to think we've got something against him. It's the second time I've cut out in the middle of one of his solos here. It's from Oliver Nelson's composition called Yearnin' off of the album The Blues and the Abstract Truth from 1961. The University of Illinois Jazz faculty will be paying tribute to that album at their concert Saturday night at the Allerton Music Barn Festival. They will be privileged to have in their midst as both moderator and flutist Oliver Nelson Jr., and I'm privileged to have him on Live and Local for our final program during the noon hour. Next Tuesday, we start doing the show from 4 to 5 p.m. instead of from 12 to 1. We won't have a show on Monday. That's Labor Day. I'm taking the day off, but we'll be back on Tuesday at the new time. And Oliver, we actually neglected to tell the story earlier, which we both meant to talk about, of the tune we played previously, which is your dad's tune called Hoedown. And my comment, as soon as it started to you and Larry and Jim, was it sounds like Aaron Copland.
Right, and that was a perfect segue for me. My family owns the rights to most of Dad's compositions, so we have a company called Noslin Music LLC that collects royalties and gives out licenses and everything. My attorney was a big fan of Bela Fleck. So we went to Ball State University in Indianapolis and got a chance to hear him. And he did Hoedown. Well, in the middle...
This Hoedown.
He did Aaron Copland's version. Mm. Booz and Hawks owns that Hoedown.
Right.
But in the middle of that Hoedown was my dad's Hoedown. So there was a copyright infringement deal there. So
double copyright.
Right, really double. Probably. Well, he had gotten approval from that Hoedown, and actually I talked to him, and he said we were going to do the whole tune, but we thought that was a bit much. So, and if I hadn't gone to that concert and heard that, because that was on his Outbound album. So my attorney, of course, gets involved in the, and the clock starts ticking financially, because these guys, it took us 2 years to kind of go through things. So I get a phone call on a Saturday night from Bela Fleck in Germany. He said, Oliver, why don't we get together and talk about this thing? So we talked, and what I basically said was, I said, Bela, why don't we do this? Why don't you pay my attorney's fees, and you come and do come and record with me? So we worked it out. Bela was doing a concert in Louisville, Kentucky. My attorney and I went down there and heard him. He rode home with us, spent the night at my house, watched a little TV with my wife and I. The next day we went and recorded one of my dad's tunes called 6 and 4. And actually that tune has got J.J. Johnson's son, Kevin Johnson, because he lives in Indianapolis and we played together a lot. So we recorded that. I put Baylor on a plane and sent him home. And they actually acknowledged my dad on the Outbound album because that was a definite copyright infringement.
Yeah,
so we kind of settled that. But Baylor was a great guy. Really fun to work with, and it was a very cool experience, even though it took 2-3 years to kind of get everything taken care of.
You know, you just raised an interesting question, and I wonder if this has ever been done. So you're the son of the famous, if you don't mind my saying, Oliver Nelson, and you just said Kevin Johnson, son of J.J. Johnson. Has anybody ever done an album of, like, sons of famous jazz musicians, sons and daughters of famous jazz musicians?
Not that I know of. But my dad and J.J. were very, very close. J.J. played with my dad in New York, recorded with dad. And then when dad moved to California, J.J. came out. This was the time when they were both writing for television. So when my dad passed away in 1975, J.J. actually took the $6 Million Man group and kept writing for them for a short time. So they were really close. And then when I came to Indianapolis and Jay had moved back to Indianapolis, then I got a chance to meet his son, Kevin, and we've played together for years. And he's a great drummer.
Do I remember right that J.J. Johnson was a trombonist?
Trombonist, yeah. Yes. Kind like of Kevin the godfather of the modern jazz trombone.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I had a professor at Northwestern whose name I'm now going to blank on, and he used to talk about J.J. Johnson a lot. And my professor called himself, you know, the loudest trombone player in the world. I never actually heard him play, and as I said, I can't now remember his name, of course. But it's really been a treat to have you on the show today.
I really appreciate being here, and I appreciate you helping me keep my dad's legacy alive by promoting the concert. And all you listeners out there, please come out. I think you'll have a great time. I'll tell you some little tidbits as well as play about dad and the music. And hopefully in the future you'll recognize not just Blues and the Abstract Truth, but all the other things that my dad has done with films. Just a quick side note, Jim was talking about the piece that he did at Eastman with my dad at the first part of the show. Well, I've got that music, and hopefully we can reproduce that here again. This hadn't been played since the early 70s. Nobody's seen it but me.
Right.
So hopefully we can get maybe Chip McNeil to play tenor saxophone on there and put a studio orchestra together and do that.
That'd be a lot of fun, and I hope we'll have the chance maybe to have you come on and play on the show sometime.
I would love to do that.
We'll look forward to it. Oliver Nelson Jr. will be moderating Saturday night's concert at the Allerton Music Barn Festival and playing flute and piccolo on the concert with University of Illinois Jazz faculty at the Allerton Music Barn Festival. Go to allertonmusicbarn.com for more information. The festival continues tonight with a sold-out performance of the Pirates of Penzance. And then on Saturday is that concert. And Sunday morning, a Bach cantata number 21. And on Sunday morning, it's the Labor Day band concert in the old Sousa style. And that'll wrap up the festival. Hope you can get to go out and hear some of it. I heard a wonderful concert by the Jupiter String Quartet last night, and that was a real treat. Hoping the weather holds out. The forecast, by the way, since I mentioned it, is a little vague on this point, although it is expected to rain this evening and through the weekend with occasional isolated thunderstorms. So hard to say just what that holds in store as far as concerts are concerned. Here are some of the events you can go see and hear live in our listening area. And starting with this tonight, the Illinois Blues Festival in downtown Peoria is happening at 7 o'clock. And An Evening with Patsy Cline continues at the Conklin's Barn 2 Dinner Theater in Goodfield tonight, tomorrow at 6 o'clock, Sunday for brunch, and for the next few weeks at least. The Eric Lund Quintet is playing at Bouvons in Urbana tonight at 7 o'clock. The Boneyard Jazz Quintet is at the Iron Post in Urbana this evening at 5. Dan Hubbard is at Main Place Bar and Grill in Decatur this evening at 6 o'clock. It's a Friday Night Live of street performances happening in downtown Champaign. Various performers on various street corners, literally, tonight starting at 6 o'clock. It's the Susan Williams Blues Band at Jim and Joe's in Danville tonight at 8 o'clock. Timber Train play at Kickapoo Landing in Oakwood tonight at 6:30. Denise LaGrassa is at Milo's Restaurant in Urbana this evening at 6 o'clock. The Aduki Trio play jazz at Michael's Restaurant in Bloomington this evening at 6. And Illinois Blues Festival continues tomorrow in Peoria. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra has three Labor Day weekend concerts. Saturday in the Old State Capitol, at the Old State Capitol in Springfield, 6 o'clock. And Sunday, I think I'm missing one of their performances. Sunday at Peterson Park Pavilion in Mattoon, that's at 6 o'clock also, and then Illinois Symphony Orchestra pops in the park at the Corn Crib in Normal, Monday, also at 6 o'clock. It's Gene Trimble's Combo playing at Douglas County Museum in Tuscola, Saturday at 6 o'clock. The Grand Avenue Big Band at Temple Plaza in Danville, Saturday at 6 o'clock. It's Millpalooza at Millikan University on the Quad in Decatur, Saturday at noon. Pork Pie and the North End All-Stars at Cuckoo's Nest in Springfield, Saturday night at 9 o'clock. Del Sur plays Latin music at the Iron Post in Urbana, Saturday evening at 6. And Doc Ashton and the Root Canals play jazz at Lincoln Park in Danville Sunday night at 7 o'clock. We have to have them on here sometime, if for no other reason than the name. Dan Hubbard's at Luca Grill in Bloomington Sunday night at 8 o'clock. And Matt and Tom Torino play at the Iron Post in Urbana Sunday night at 7. And on Monday, it's the Millikan Decatur Symphony Labor Day Pops Concert at Nelson Park Amphitheater in Decatur. That's Monday at 6 o'clock. You're listening to Live and Local on 90.9 WYL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. We are a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. And we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine, beers, and spirits for the series collected to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available on the Corkscrew's Facebook page. And reminder that starting Tuesday, Live and Local will air from 4 to 5 p.m. And as of today, we are done at the noon hour. I'm Kevin Kelly. Thanks for joining me today. And let's go out with a tune that Jim Pugh mentioned earlier that they'll be doing in their own arrangement, or his own arrangement, on Saturday's concert. This is the final cut from Blues in the Abstract Truth. It's Oliver Nelson's Teenie's Blues.